This audio file is a production of the University of Chicago Law School. Visit us on the web at www.law.uchicago.edu.
I should warn you before I start that I tend to gravitate towards topics where I think I have something contrarian to say. Maybe that's very Chicago, or maybe that's just the way I am or something. And, you know, part of my disappointment, in a sense, with this topic is I don't really feel very contrarian. I feel like what you're about to hear is really pretty common sense. I mean, how can anybody disagree, as you'll see? And so I don't really have, don't wait for some huge contrarian or startling punchline, because I don't really have one. I think this is actually a really easy to set out problem. And then, you know, there are a few solutions if you think there's a problem that I think are really pretty straightforward, some of which have been discussed, some of which may appear in the future and therefore might be original or something. And so with that word of warning, here I go. So I've divided into three parts. The first part is just set out a little bit of a positive scheme. And then I want to introduce the sort of typical law and economics move of what a hypothetical bargain would look like among everybody. And then I want to get to the law and where I think it either is going or ought to go or what I think is going on. So first, I want to compare the internet to a variety of media. I feel like everybody's looking over my shoulder. Is there something really exciting written there? Yeah, well, actually there is. Okay, so when you're done reading, here we are. I want to compare the internet to a variety of media, and the first step is just to I've picked some popular other forms of communication, and I just want to sort of set out the idea that although you could argue for more regulation of one medium over another, you know, you could rank them in a variety of orders, it's comparing, you know, apples, oranges, pears, etc., that really the internet will stand out, at least in its present historical phase, as an outlier. That, wow, it's pretty unregulated, and although there are arguments for and against regulating each medium, it's a little bit surprising, you know, where the internet is. And because that, I think, will make us a little bit more comfortable with thinking that maybe there's some problem that deserves a little bit of regulation. And so that's where I'm going to go. So let me do that part first. So I have a funny acronym in my mind of TWINS, so I can remember the media I want to talk about. T is for TV, W is for wall, like the bathroom wall. This is not as hot a medium as it once was. But when I was in middle school, that's where we did most of our communicating. And it was a constant array. Still, if you go to Medici, you see that. It's sort of a popular medium. Someone goes to the bathroom, you know, they write what they think of their classmate, and then the classmate comes in and they write something back, and then eventually somebody goes to the owner of Medici and says, this is disgusting. You should delete what's on the bathroom wall, and they try to do some erasing. It's sort of like, you know, local graffiti, if you will. This is I mean, the rise of the internet, I kid you not, has caused the drop in the bathroom wall. When I first visited this law school as a visiting faculty member many years ago, the bathroom stalls had tons of information about faculty, the then sitting dean, and classmates. And now, you know, why bother? You go to Juicy Campus and you call the dean a slut or whatever it is that you say about me. More on, oh, it was you that wrote that. I was wondering who that was. And that's what we'll get to. But you could think of that as a medium anyway. And then there's the internet, and then just picking one print medium. Let's just pick newspapers. And then I also wanted to pick a sort of traditional one of the soapbox. You know, there is this possibility that you just, you know, as they do in London, but you could do that on the Midway, put up some chair, stand up there, try to attract an audience, rant and rave about your favorite topic. So we want to think about how these various media are regulated. And I think this is a sort of straightforward thing. You know, take them one at a time. In the case of television, the traditional government argument has been that we're entitled to regulate it a little bit. Not too many, you know, F words, especially during prime time, and maybe some equal access rules if you talk about a political candidate. I mean, we're sort of familiar with this regulation. The usual argument for it, I mean, the normal state would be either libertarian or First Amendment means leave people alone. But there is government regulation, a substantial amount of it. And the usual argument has something to do with the scarcity of the airwaves. Government's giving out these airwaves. There isn't an infinite amount of bandwidth. Therefore, that would be reason for some regulation. A sort of secondary thing might be protection of children during certain hours of the day. although I'm not really here to talk about that today. But I want to keep the scarcity out there. In the bathroom wall situation, the control comes mainly, I mean, there is defamation law there, but usually you don't really know who's defamed you. Most people don't have the good grace to sign the stuff they write about you. But there are vandalism cases, right? So in most bathroom stalls, if you write something horrid on the wall and you're caught, it's only like a probably 1 in 100 chance of being caught on the way out or something, but it could happen. And, you know, so there's a vandalism charge against you, maybe a defamation charge as well. If you do etch disgusting things in the bathroom wall, my advice is not to sign your email address or phone number or anything like that. But most people, you know, they don't do that. They have little pseudonym stage names they use. And when I grew up in New York, Taki 138 was the most prolific subway writer and bathroom stall writer. And eventually he was tracked down. Does anybody happen to remember Taki 138? Taki 138 was estimated by the New York Times to have over 110,000 messages around New York. And eventually he was tracked down, this guy. And he turned out to be a high school classmate of mine. Which, you know, immediately, you know, my parents were embarrassed, but we were very, very proud. I mean, we knew the Shakespeare of our time who could, you know, attach the F word to anybody you ever heard of and become famous, you know, all over for his green paint and so forth. So there he is, and he was arrested. I mean, they figured him out, and he was arrested. And there was, you know, I think he pled guilty to some minor vandalism charge. And of course, the arrest just made him more famous and, you know, improved his academic credentials as a good author. He went to Princeton after that. They were happy to have him because of his vandalism youth, and he served his suspended sentence there. So, you know, I think bathroom wall seems reasonably well controlled. I mean, I'll return there in a minute, but I'm, you know, newspapers, that's the one most students know the most out of, right? We read about them in the paper. There's publisher liability. So the publisher of the paper is careful about these bounds of law involved in defamation. They might use a source. We don't mind if the reporter goes to a source that's anonymous. And newspapers work pretty hard to protect these sources. But the publisher is liable, and publishers are pretty careful. And we could do a whole talk on newspapers. But in the modern era, let's say last 150 years, newspapers have moved from being unbelievably salacious, anonymous cesspools to pretty well controlled by just a small thread of litigation, advertiser pushback, and consumer preferences. Newspapers are now a pretty staid medium over there. And, you know, even letters to the editor, I mean, they're not going to publish your letter to the editor unless it's signed. They might sometimes withhold your name if you're, like, you're a whistleblower or something. But they will. All these newspapers will check up to make sure you're the one that really wrote the letter, and you know that's actually a pretty careful thing. And law seems to have a lot to do with it. Even soapboxes. Anybody who travels to London, you know, a big stop is to go to Hyde Park to Speaker's Corner, where these sort of crazy people are up on soapboxes going on and on. They're sort of a tourist attraction. You know, if they disturb the peace or they start defaming known people, the police come along and, you know, club them to death or something. I mean, they really just pull them off the soapbox. But I was unaware of this. When someone brought it to my attention, I went to Google this, and yeah, sure enough, pictures of police pulling people down. And again, they're pretty well behaved up there. They say scurrilous things, but it doesn't rise. And besides, the audience consists of, you know, 25 visiting Americans from Wisconsin who don't know any of these local people at all. So the audience is very small. Presumably that controls it. You know, if you compare all that, you know, each one with its own regulation to the internet, I guess you know this even better than I, the internet is pretty regulation-free. Not entirely, but pretty regulation-free, mostly accomplished by statute. I'll give you some language from the statute later on. But the statute is complicated. First, the statute says that the internet provider or other intermediary shall not be treated as a publisher or author. So, you know, Verizon is safe. You know, the entrepreneur on Above the Law is safe. You know, they let everybody post, and if you want to let everybody post and you want them to post scurrilous stuff, the internet provider, the forum provider, unlike the publisher of the newspaper, is not responsible. Again, this is not unheard of. It's a little bit like imagining that the newspaper comes into being because of the publisher, the logging company that cut down trees and made them into paper, and Borders, you know, for selling newspapers and books. And, you know, the liability threat to Borders or the logging company is really, really, really tiny. I mean, they have no obligation to go read the books and look around and try to find some. But there is one intermediary that has an interest in monitoring, or at least one intermediary, and we could think of that as the publisher. Again, if you think the right analog to the publisher in online fora are these providers, the provider is specifically, by federal law, treated not like the forum provider, any forum provider we know of in the newspaper world. Also, the poster on the internet could be sued directly. The statute does not free up. I mean, if I get on the internet site and I, you know, write something, you know, really, really horrible about another faculty member here, well, that faculty member could try to sue me directly for defamation or some other traditional claim, but they got to find me first. Again, I don't know that we need to go into that at great length today because it could take all our time, but it's not so easy to find me. Most internet providers will seem to think that they'll do better once they let me post of protecting me and not me. Oh, you thought what he wrote was wrong? Well, you know, here's who he really is. Here's his IP address. Here's the. And instead, you got to go to court, as you know, for these cases. You got to have to convince a judge an overwhelming likelihood of your winning in a direct suit against me before Verizon will be forced to cough up their IP address. It's sort of a lot of effort. It's very hard to do. It's done very rarely. So I don't want to say there's no regulation, but it's certainly at the outer bounds. It's the most regulation-free of all these media. And then the question is what to make of it and what we'll do with it, and that's where I'm going to occupy my time. You know, the result, I think, is plain. For all that we might love the internet, and I will soon commend many sites on it, both anonymous and not, you know, I think you understand from the title of this talk what I'm after. I'm after the scurrilous sites. You know, is there anybody here who has not visited juicycampus.com? Wow. This reminds me, though, a little bit of the minister who says, today my talk is about honesty. Is there anybody who has not read Psalm 153? And everyone says they've read Psalm 153, and the minister says, it's to you whom I'm talking because there is no Psalm 153. So wow, there are really that many people that have never visited juicycampus.com. It's a little bit like when you were small children, the AOL chat room. You know, someone raises a topic. I need to describe Juicy Campus to you. If we just open up a general website and say, post your gossip. You know, the problem is you'll gossip about me, and I'll gossip about you, and you'll gossip about someone who lives in Italy. And even if it's searchable, you know, entering, you know, ooh, what do you got about Amy? Well, you know, 100,000 Amys in the world. You won't really find the Amy you want to read the gossip about. So Juicy Campus, you know, parallels normal sites. So like you enter your campus, you know, you write Princeton, or University of Chicago is now on juicycampus.com. It was not this summer when I started reading or obsessing over the site. But University of Chicago is there now. It's a minor site. There are only, you know, 20 or 30 messages on it. But if you go there and you put in, you know, Princeton or University of Virginia, where I went to visit that site last night, anticipating some questions today, you go there and then you can look what the latest topic is. The topic, you know, maybe once upon a time was, who's a really good teacher for intro anthro? You know, I might think of that as useful. Or, you know, where do you get the best burger on campus? You know, in the beginning, there were some threads like that. That's all gone. It could still be there, but that's all gone. And it's all like, you know, who's the biggest bitch on campus? You'll have to excuse my language for this talk. You know, who's the hottest this? Who's the stupidest that? Actually, there's nothing as refined as who's the stupidest, come to think of it. I might say, you know, who is the most arrogant jerk on campus? That is, although arrogant is a little bit sophisticated word for Juicy Campus. It's really pretty base. And often people don't respond. And then often there are a lot of responses. Then you hit on replies, and you can read the replies. And, you know, it's a typical online, speedy, jerky site. You know, it's got very little useful information, but a lot of scurrilous stuff. And most of the words are misspelled in some combination of misspelling and G-chat kind of talk. You know, it's kind of complicated. And, you know, every once in a while, there's kind of interesting information that is reasonably specific and makes you think, oh, this might be true. You know, like, who's the biggest sorority slut? That seems to be the most common question on campus. You know, when you read this, when you're my age, the whole thing seems like a strange world because, you know, I could see reasons why people might want to hear. First of all, I'm never sure what they mean. Well, given my repressed upbringing, I not only I'm not sure what they mean by slut, but I'm not sure what they mean by sorority. I mean, I don't really kind of understand a lot of these terms, having not been part of them. But even do they, in a lot of ways. The answers are just great. You know, oh, it's, you know, Amy saw Amy X. I saw Amy X behind, you know, Boodle Hall. Whoa, the next person writes, behind Boodle Hall, go, two thumbs up. Like, what? It's very, very hard to follow. But it builds up. There are like 20 or 30 of these comments, and they and then, you know, they're very, very painful if you're Amy X. I mean, because they know, you know, they're vulnerable. Right? We're all vulnerable. You think you're not vulnerable until one of these sites is about you. And then they'll go, she's not so bad. She, blah, blah, blah. Next person, right. Not only is she bad, she's fat. Whoa. You know, now you could just see the poor Amy X reading this. And then 15 more people write, go, yeah, can you think of anyone fatter? You know, and then it just goes, it's really just vile. So I'm not going to keep doing this for you. I mean, there's this fear when you're a speaker that people laugh and you want to give them more of whatever it is that made them laugh. But you can go read these sites as well. Just don't spend too much time there. That's about the level of sophistication of the sites. So that's what I mean in the rest of this talk when I use the word juvenile. I mean, it's full of juvenile talk that maybe is harmless for most of the participants, and maybe it's just a waste of time for most speakers. But in fact, then there are people like Amy X who are really hurt. Eventually, she finds out that she has become the subject of this site. And of course, you can find that out in a minute by searching. These are all searchable sites. So you can put Amy X in the local Juicy Campus Princeton site, and then you go find out what's been written about your friends or about yourself and so forth. And then some people become, alas, minor celebrities. It's virtually never positive. It's almost always negative. It's not all racist or sexist or something like that, but a lot of it is. It's sort of purposefully politically incorrect, and it starts out sometimes with a little humor, and then, you know, it winds down, and, you know, you get the general idea. It's kind of it's titillation and juvenilism and all that. Okay. And it lives forever. You know, there it is online. All right, now I'm going to speed up to get to some law, and then I'm going to return to Juicy Campus at the end. So lots of reasons to think there can be no regulation. I'll just speed through this. I think the normal answer in most of these media is consumers can avoid it. If you don't like dirty words on television after 10 p.m., you don't have to turn on your TV. You can put a control on the box, a V-chip kind of thing, a more sophisticated one. Your kids don't have to do it. And besides, you know, one person screams First Amendment, but advertisers seem to think it's not so cool to be associated with juvenilism on TV or offense on TV. It ends up, you know, maybe we don't need a lot of regulation, you might say, and that seems to be where most of the world is. The Medici walls, the owner has a big incentive to erase it. And so it's short-lived. They write Amy X as a slut on the bathroom wall. It comes down pretty fast. We delete things written on our bathroom wall, if it happens. Newspaper is a little trickier. Newspapers have this highbrow, vaulted view in American law. Remy arising out of handbills, which was once an important political thing. But again, I think not that much of a problem because of their internal self-control, as long as government stays out of it. That is, I think people would really object if they thought there was one newspaper in Milwaukee and it was owned by the local Republican Party. That would be troubling. But so long as the government stays out of it, you could think of that as the form of regulation. We allow this sort of competition with these rules about defamation and not the equal access that we give television stations. Again, I'll return to that. The soapbox has got a lot of social sanctions attached to it. When the guy gets up on the soapbox, the local people can see who it is. So it's sort of identifiability or non-anonymity to the hilt. Again, as you know from the title, that's where I'm coming back to, that at a minimum, non-anonymous speakers really, that erases a good amount of the juvenile and worse behavior. Very, very few people are juvenile on the soapbox in a serious way. You know, look how rarely somebody raises. Well, I've often thought about this in class. Why don't people raise their hand in class and say vile things? You know, it's so rare that somebody does anything, you know, untoward in class. But nobody ever jumps up and starts screaming out four-letter words, even in college, even in high school. I mean, there's sort of social sanction and some imagined fear of reprisal. I think, you know, makes most people very well behaved. When you know that people know who you are. It's anonymity that seems to bring this out in most people. So I want to just assert, we could argue about it later, that the internet is quite an outlier. It's protected by this Communications Decency Act of 1996. Oh, I promise the language. No provider or user of an interactive computer service shall be treated as the publisher or speaker of any information provided by another information content provider. If you said, what's the reason, the legislative history and the stated reason is something like, oh, it's a new medium, let's let it flourish and see what happens. Okay, well, now we know what happens. You know, what do we want to do? I think it's obvious that juvenilism reduces the value of a medium, right? If we put up a big wall on campus and we said, everybody should write what they think on the wall, you know, it might begin with congratulations to Barack Obama, but, you know, once people get the idea that they can start slurring people and writing all sorts of stuff, you know, a free good like that is eventually overwhelmed by people writing junk on it. You know, I think about the graffiti one finds around the world. So I think that's a central part of what comes, that if you like speech, you need actually, if you think speech is valuable, you probably should prefer for it to be a little controlled in order to raise the value of the medium, though you're always worried that whoever it is that's controlling the speech is doing it in a biased way. Like, ideally, you'd like some unbiased way to control speech because you recognize that a free wall is not really a very valuable wall. And that's, I think that's the sort of central idea. In fact, you know, there are a lot of providers that provide free walls with deletions. You know, they're usually pretty specific, but think of Amazon.com with reviews of books, or CNET for reviews of electronic goods. When you go visit CNET, if you're trying to decide what MP3 player to buy or something, you go there, there's a lot of useful information, a lot of not useful information, probably a lot of biased information, but there's very little juvenile information. No one says, well, the person who said to get the iPod Touch is a blank, 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 blank. It just doesn't happen. And of course, I think the answer is it does. Of course it happens. It's just that CNET is monitoring the sites. They have some, you know, robotware that is getting rid of four-letter words as a matter of course. And then they're also visiting the site and getting rid of it. Just to jump ahead, those of you who are really into Wikipedia, as I am, are quite familiar with this. If you post really vile things on Wikipedia, if you edit on Wikipedia, how many people have ever edited on Wikipedia? That's not enough. You need to. I was hoping you'd be here today because I know how much you like items for the trivia quiz, but how many editors are there on Wikipedia right now?
You mean how many people have ever edited?
No, have registered and edit, meaning semi-professional editors.
I don't know. Do you want me to guess?
Well, I don't know. Isn't that how you get most of these trivia questions right, by guessing?
My guess would be very educated.
Well, go ahead. I don't mean to put you on the spot. Anybody else want to guess?
Million.
How many?
1 million.
1 million. Wow. No, 75,000. But 75,000 people who take it really seriously, plus probably 1 million who go once in a blue moon, that's enough, so to speak, I think. I mean, if you go read Wikipedia, it's amazing. And you could do experiments. I mean, I don't recommend this, but high school kids do this. Try purposely posting incorrect things on Wikipedia. Try putting Amy X as a slut on Wikipedia. If you, in the middle of a site, write Amy X as a slut, you go to the bathroom and come back, it's gone. That is, there's some robo stuff that's going out there looking for words like slut and removing them. If you put just incorrect information, Amy X was a high school classmate of Barack Obama, that will last a couple hours. You know, something gross. I mean, there are people checking Obama all the time. That cannot work from RoboWare. And if you put something more obscure, like, you know, not about Obama, but about someone no one cares about, you know, you write something about John McCain in there, and, you know, you put, well, actually, you know, he was a teaching assistant at the University of Chicago Law School in 1929. That will last until the weekend. I say that on purpose. That's a sort of interesting fact about Wikipedia, is you could see that most of these people are amateurs with a great interest in Wikipedia. And they're doing their editing when they're not at work. I mean, they have a lot of free time. And they do that on weekends. And on weekends is when a lot of the junk comes out. I mean, it's a very, very efficient thing, except that's hardly efficient from our point of view. It is from Wikipedia's point of view, because it requires 75,000 plus hundreds of thousands of free laborers, basically. So it's very, very expensive central control, central censorship, in a way, that's making it accurate. The Chicago Tribune has to pay a few editors, you know, to watch the letters to the editor and make sure reporters aren't trying to put in stupid stuff. But somebody who runs a big internet site Well, you know, it's expensive to do that. If you want to keep Amazon.com and CNN and Wikipedia clean, you need to put in a lot of effort. The whole idea of the internet was to allow, you know, the University of Chicago Law School to have a website. You have a blog. You have a blog. You know, and we're not about to do this. Well, you see the problem, right? So that one price of juvenile behavior is poor Amy X. It's the person who suffers the loss of being the target. The other price is that it gets at the core of what the internet was supposed, one of the things it was supposed to accomplish. That the entrepreneur, if you will, who finally sees this medium with a very, very low cost of entry, suddenly finds that the cost of entry is pretty high. Because if you open up a non-monitored site on anything of interest to anybody, you will be overwhelmed with, you might be overwhelmed with juvenile behavior, and the only way to offset that, so law helps you by saying, oh, don't worry, you're not responsible. But of course, as soon as it says that, if the juveniles attack you, then the site is overwhelmed and, you know, nobody wants to read it. I mean, no one's going to go read Amazon.com or CNET if the useful information was, you know, 1/100th of the total. Again, there are a few sites that survive, like Juicy Campus, meaning survives despite the fact that it's a free wall of cesspool crap. But that's just because it's targeted. There is a market for people at Princeton or at the University of Virginia who want to read cesspool stuff about people there and about people they know. It's a pretty limited market. That doesn't make Amy X feel any better. But it is there, and that's, you know, the level of the juvenile behavior. There are, of course, mixed sites, which I'll return to, Above the Law, for example, which I will come back to in a minute. I don't want to just rant and rail against anonymity. You know, there are sites. I used to play Second Life as part of a project, and I got out of it. I don't know if other people have been there. Second Life? Serious Second Life players? Serious. You don't want to admit being serious. Serious Second Life? Well, I'm glad you're busy law students. Just for the record, I did it as part of a seminar. So I got teaching credit for playing Second Life. You know, in that kind of virtual world, anonymity, I think, is very beautiful and liberating. So I don't know, maybe this is not the sort of thing one should say in public, but after reading how people behaved on Second Life, I changed my avatar. And I was on, with another person on the, then on the faculty here now. He was a law and economics fellow. I became a female on Second Life. About 14% of people, I don't know what the word is, crossvatar or something. I mean, there must be a word for that. But, and you know, actually it was very interesting. It was suggested to me by somebody. It was a very good idea. Even though everybody playing Second Life knows that the thing they're dealing with might not be what it seems to be, an old person might be young, and even though they know this woman might be a man, nevertheless, people can't help themselves in a way. And I think actually it gave me insight into how people treat women or pick up women or the like. This is actually very, very interesting. I actually recommend it to you. It's very interesting to try to be, you know, Dick Posner is the only one I know whose avatar in Second Life is himself. And he didn't create the avatar. It was created for him by somebody else. That is, most people, I think, you learn more. And the point of anonymity, in a way, is to try to be beyond yourself and learn a little bit more about the world. So I think there are uses for it. I don't mean that it should always be. Okay. Bargaining for a couple minutes. So I have this very law and economics view, which won't surprise you, leaving the First Amendment aside, is that if we put 1,000 people in a room, or all of Princeton in a room, and we said to them, well, what bargain, what rules of law, rules of social convention do you want in your community? How do you feel about anonymity on the internet? I think that they would overwhelmingly, if informed, vote against anonymity. That is, I think there'd be some people who put a little bit of value to be able to taunt people and get away with it. But, you know, every potential Amy X, or anyone who had ever experienced it, would think that the cost of being targeted was very, very high. And, you know, to sound like an econ person, you know, I'm confident that Amy X could pay her cyber bullies to stop taunting her. You know, if it was a perfect market, I think the pain that she feels is pretty great, and she would pay a lot of money not to be kicked, if we want to use the language of elementary torts. The problem with that, of course, is that such markets fail. There's market failure because, first of all, she can't find them and communicate with them. Second of all, they can extort people who have no interest in kicking. If you have to pay me not to kick you, I'll walk over and make believe I like kicking. You know, so we won't even be valuing the actual kicking fetishes that exist. We'll get a lot of people who make believe they have kicking fetishes or cyberbullying fetishes or what it is. in order to get paid. I mean, I think this is familiar to anybody who's thought about tort law. So there's a real market failure, I think, and at least I am confident that the value of this kind of free speech is either low or negative or something compared to the harm Amy X feels, and again, ex ante, you don't know if you'll be a targeted person or not. I'm pretty confident that if you put these 1,000 people together in the usual manner that we make law, people would vote for this. That is, they would bargain for it, and since they can't bargain for it, they would vote for a kind of default rule against it. You can imagine a little more sophisticated. Maybe Princeton could set up two sites and say, there's a site you go to if you want these rules, and there's a site you go to if you want non-anonymity. Again, that doesn't really help Amy X very much, because she might be, well, the rule could be that you express taste for which site you want, and if 10,000 people go to the non-anonymous site and 300 hardy souls go to the taunting site, then the rule is they can taunt all they want within their community of the 300 people or something. I mean, these experiments are just thought experiments. They're not enforceable. So no one tries to do it, because on the taunting site, you could defect and immediately taunt Amy X, even though she opted out of that site. So I don't really see much potential there. I don't mean that non-anonymity is the only solution for Amy X. We could try a copyright-style notice and takedown rule, where maybe if you know there's something offensive, you ask for it to come down, and then it comes down short of some review for truth or whatever it is. I also like to think of a right of response. Maybe if I know something's up on a site maligning me or just offensive, I can respond on the site. Again, that's hard to do. It's hard to put it side by side. It's hard to offset some of the claims that are made about you. I don't think I would mind any of these experiments. The point is that on these most juvenile sites, we have none of these experiments at all. So if you don't like this discussion, as part two suggests, come on, we shouldn't have Juicy Campus by bargain. They're just taking advantage of Amy X and her inability to bargain with them. But if that's not your view, then it must be that you think there's some constitutional trump. That, oh, there's this First Amendment right for free speech, and you know, give me liberty and give me death, and Amy X is a slut, are so closely related that we can never separate them. And therefore, we need a rule or an environment in which people are free to speak whatever they want. And, you know, there's wonderful graffiti, political graffiti out there, and the price of getting it is to have a lot of tacky 138s, T-A-K-I was his pseudonym, out there. Maybe. You know, it's not true of most individual rights. There are lots of individual, you know, wiretapping. A majority would vote not to have wiretapping. You know, there are a lot of individual rights we have where an ex-ante bargain would produce protection of the right. I mean, it's not that every individual right we have is counter-majoritarian, but I think that if you like the Juicy Campuses of the world, your view has to be something like, I don't care if a majority of people don't like it. A majority of people would say, no protesting against the government. That doesn't mean we think it's a good idea just because a majority goes for it. And we need some constitutional protection from it. So I should wind down, though. I should have saved more time for this. You know, I think that whenever there's a social problem, I'm going to call this a social problem, whenever there's a perceived social problem, we expect, in most cases, politics to either react or even overreact to it. You know, if we have gang violence, that's a really... We don't even know if gang violence is an important part of violence or not important or whatever, but it's a natural thing for politicians to say, "Oh, gang violence. Vote for me, I'll stop gangs, I'll have a special police force about gangs." And you know, gangs are not so politically well organized. So the sort of public choice aspect of it usually means that when there's a perceived social problem, politicians are likely to regulate or overregulate. What's interesting about this example is that I think it runs the other way. There is a perceived social problem, but the people who are the future Amy X's are really quite dispersed. We don't know that we should be objecting to it, if you will. And in fact, there's a much stronger interest group that believes that any government intervention against presumed free speech is a bad idea. It's this thing we inherit as a society where a good number of people, especially intellectuals, believe that First Amendment means you should be able to say anything you want anywhere, anyhow, except screaming fire in a movie theater. And therefore, it's a huge burden on anybody that wants to put restrictions on it, especially in a new medium. I obviously don't feel that way. I almost don't understand why people feel that way. But I only mean it now as a positive matter, that a politician that would stand up and say, I'm going to wipe out the Juicy Campus cesspool, would be an unpopular politician, probably, because people would say, ooh, this is really a reactionary anti-First Amendment person. But, you know, they might at least be pressured to move the internet to where newspapers are. You know, repealing Section 230 of the Communications Decency Act would be one way to do that, at least to have normal defamation rules and the right to, you know, find out the IP address of the person who's maligned you or something. Could also imagine websites being forced to self-declare. You say whether you're an entertainment website or a communication website. Doesn't solve AMIAX's problem entirely, but at least that would avoid some of the mixing. I mean, if you like reading Above the Law or other sites like that, it has some useful information on it, but there's something really horrible about going to a website like that and then finding out that you're in the bathroom stall. I mean, you go to the website, there's a economics one like this, there are a bunch of travel ones like this. I was looking at information for Venice where I was traveling this summer. It's the site where you should go, oh, you should go early to this one, then that one, then that. And then in the middle of the whole thing, you know, horrible comments about, you know, the anatomy of somebody, a real person that you would find at this site. It's sort of vile. You know, titillating is not even the right word because it was so vile that it could only appeal to, but the startle effect was really great. And you think, well, why? Why does the First Amendment require living in a world where when that person finds out what's been said by her on this site, it's very costly. I mean, that's real pain. I'm not sure it's pain that any of us could avoid or would want to avoid. We have a little bit of this, right? The New York Times and the National Enquirer, it's as if they self-identify. Oh, we're serious? We're entertainment. The problem with that model is that the National Enquirer never writes about me. I mean, they only care about celebrities. The problem with Juicy Campus is it's like having the National Enquirer with a very focused audience. It's the National Enquirer for the University of Chicago Law School, for Princeton. If you had the Chicago Enquirer and they started having, you know, raunchy, crazy, implausible, entertaining things about, you know, eight people in this room, I think we would feel very differently and we would object a little bit more. Again, it might be good. I mean, admits to a law school might do a good job checking some real site that isn't afraid to tell the truth about a law school, even if it had on it some vile stuff. I don't see why it has to have the vile, but I understand that you might not get that with the total anonymity rule, because I might not want to say, as a student at Princeton, here's what's really horrible about my faculty, here are some classmates that are really obnoxious. I mean, I might not write that if I have to identify myself. So there's, of course, a cost to this. And the question is whether we're willing to balance the cost. So I'll make a prediction and then stop. I think that more and more internet entrepreneurs will limit participation. They'll just get rid of the open wall. Or they'll require identification. For example, to log on, you might need to use your credit card number, even though there'd be no cost. And then they would have high confidence that you were who you said you were. So I think we will find more and more internet entrepreneurs making their sites more valuable by having identification of the speakers. I think that will leave a few Juicy Campuses, just as it leaves a few hard porn shops in city centers. But I mean, there is, outside of the mainstream, a few sort of odd sites, in a way, that don't appeal to the mainstream, but that do appeal to some people. You know, then in some generations, law goes to great effort to eradicate those sites or suppress them. Some generations, law celebrates them or sends them all to Amsterdam or does. That's my prediction for the next 10 or 15 years, that they will form a periphery and law will go up or down depending on how much attention Amy X can get when she goes before Congress. Thanks. Your turn. Here's where you ask questions. Yes? Mr. Cleary.
So I think that you're ignoring, intentionally or otherwise, and at the expense of focusing on things like AMIAX's slot, the very real benefits that do come from anonymity. And I think one German example is on Chalk, when you have the opportunity to ask a professor a question anonymously or naming it, the vast majority are anonymous, because nobody wants to ask the dumb question, yet everybody still gets the benefit of that. Similarly, if the next day in class, everybody posted on the wall, or the teacher posted on the wall, who came up to them after class for help to ask questions, there would still be a loss there. And, you know, you sort of hinted at it with the self-discovery when you pretended to be a woman, and maybe there's some value coming from that. But there are lots of values that come from anonymity in the internet, which you didn't any need to at all.
Okay, well, first of all, that still then raises the puzzle of why we don't do that in newspapers. So I'm not claiming to know the right equilibrium. I'm just pointing out that we've had, you know, hundreds of years of experience with these other media. That's why I started there. And the puzzle for you, in a way, is why the social and legal balance has settled in those other media, where anonymity is also valuable. It's settled in one place with vandalism, with defamation claims and the like, and the internet is plainly the outlier. So we can always find an advantage to more speech in any medium. We can always find a cost. There is something puzzling about the outlier effect. That's one level of response. Number two, I think interaction makes a big difference. So in this paper that this is a part of, I say more about this. But for example, course critiques. They're anonymous, I think wisely so. My experience with course critiques, as the paper spells out, I believe I have as much experience in them as anyone in America, because I read all the course evaluations and have for, let's say, seven or eight years. They're amazingly constructive and respectful. It's unbelievable how rare it is that somebody writes anything that you would think, ooh, I'd be a little embarrassed for someone else to read this. They're great, and they're completely anonymous. I think that it's not only because maybe we have a mature student body, but I think it's also because they're not interactive. I think if it was the sort of site where I posted something about Professor Smith, and you did, and she did, and he did, and you went back and back, that kind of builds up this frenzy. If you begin to write something a little close to the edge, besides, you know, he's too stuck up on himself, And then stuck up. I saw and the next thing you know, it's a series of four-letter words. The fact that the course critique or the comments to the professor in the office are written once, maybe the professor responds, but there's not this piling on thing, I think it actually makes it quite safe. So I actually don't really worry. I think you're quite right that anonymity, the option of anonymity, is of great benefit. It also is of cost. I mean, you need to ask yourself whether you gain more by asking a question anonymously online or coming to my office and asking me the question where you can have interaction with the professor. I'm not sure we should just elevate anonymity. But I agree with you, but it's not interactive. And I think it's the interactive part of the internet that I think is bringing about a lot of this cost of the anonymity. But I think you're right.
I don't know if you're familiar with the roommates.com decision last year, where Judge Kaczynski interpreted Section 230 and basically said that sites that encourage defamatory speech could be regulated even under Section 230. So I wonder if that decision, A, would apply to sites like Juicy Campus, where, you know, the name Juicy Campus does sort of imply we want dirt, we want, you know, Amy X is a slut. And secondly, does this indicate that courts are moving in a new direction?
Well, no, right? I mean, if ever there was an outlier, it's Judge Kaczynski. So just to say it's a Judge Kaczynski decision, you know, just tells you that the answer is no. There's no other evidence for such a trend.
You seem to write off the ability for a traditional defamation or libel claim to go after people. The first thing that comes to mind is the fact that sort of the recording industry finds anonymous file sharers all the time under subpoenaing information. Why do you think that would work?
Yeah, that's a really good point. Of course, the recording industry does this in part by having universities on its side because it threatens them with liability, because it can tell what server things come from. So I don't think that's your best example. They don't do well going to some teenager's house in suburban Maryland and finding the person. They do well going through servers that they get access to with threats of liability and essentially complicity. But we actually have a graduate who used to be in charge of this for the RIAA. So, I mean, it was interesting to watch how they would go about it. Nevertheless, your point's a good one, even if you're wrong about that or partially wrong about that. You know, it's high effort. I mean, partly, you know, defamation ain't what it used to be. You know, certainly most four-letter words that you can attach to people are not defamatory these days. I've been trying to be careful to say juvenile rather than defamatory. You know, yes, I think the defamatory threat is what got the newspapers to sort of believe and sign letters to the editor. I mean, that of course, should have been my response to Mr. Cleary, but I stayed away from it because of his experience with newspapers. You know, if you were right, newspapers would love anonymous letters. You know, it's really interesting that they don't.
They love anonymous sources.
Yeah, but that's because they think the sources have to be intermediated through a reporter who has a reputation. So even though they could police the letters and just delete some, not delete some, they don't want the anonymous letters, and they have every reason to want to be controversial, you know. They don't. I mean, that's a pretty good market test to me about the value of the free wall. So I guess I feel the same way there. Again, I I think both questions started with the right phrase, which is, I seem to be undervaluing the yes. I'm not trying to be an advocate, but I mean, yes, of course, whenever we propose regulation or wonder why we don't see regulation, in this case, it's not that we don't see regulation, it's that we see special protection. That's the way I would think about Section 230. There's special protection for the internet. I think that sort of puts the burden on Congress to ask, well, why don't they do that for newspapers if it's so great? Why don't they do that for the bathroom wall if it's so great? So it does raise this puzzle. You could picture other interest groups, maybe Verizon's a big campaign contributor. You know, there are other ways to think about why we have this asymmetrical rule, and that's really what I'm getting at. But of course, every intervention, whether pro or anti-anonymity, will have its costs. The question is, you know, where the right balance is. And all I'm suggesting is that the more I think about the hypothetical bargains we would see, you know, I didn't start out this way, actually. But the more I see them, the more my heart goes out to Amy X. It's kind of horrible with no apparent social gain, you know, whatsoever. You know? Yep.
So I want to offer, or try to offer an explanation for why this isn't regulated. It's a little bit different, and see what you think about it. So you say it might be a few things. It might be people who like constitutional rights. It might be this like hypothetical bargain would work or fails. What if it's that it's just not really possible to regulate it? So it's really hard to like even regulate your domestic internet service providers. Like China does it. They try really hard, and it's widely perceived as an abysmal failure. Anybody that's you know relatively internet literate in China could still get anything they want through a proxy. The United States could like tomorrow put down a rule that says you know get rid of this protection for internet service providers, have like harsh liability, but you could open one you know a juicy campus Somalia where like no one could ever get you basically. So maybe there's a realization at some level that harsh restrictions just aren't going to work in the internet because the costs of setting up and the costs of communicating are so low. You know, and even if you did decide that you could do it, like nothing happens effectively. Anybody that knows what they're doing can get to the information anyway.
Yeah. I have thought about this a little bit. Everybody heard the question? I think it was clear. So let me just enrich the question a little bit and get on your side. The same is true for a lot of domestic things, like giving out handbills. I could publish a lot of scurrilous things about students and colleagues and then just come in the middle of the night and leave them all over the law school. And, you know, the chance of being caught is really, really low. And, you know, right. What's the difference? Well, of course, people do that occasionally. But it's rare. Maybe it's rare the way Juicy Campus will be rare, in which case we don't have to worry about it that much. The obvious difference is that Juicy Campus is searchable and widely distributed, and you go to set up Juicy Campus Somalia, and in theory, you know, millions and millions of people can read it. Though again, I don't think they will. They need to be searchable. You've got to do Juicy Campus in Somalia and direct it to Princeton. You know, have focus groups. Yeah, exactly. Although not anymore. But let's leave that aside. I mean, there are these intermediary. Google is not in Somalia. So Google can be regulated, and Google will self-regulate. And, you know, go Google. Google will not take you to lots of Juicy Campus junk. So there is this market or a threat of regulation or just common sense pressure that does reduce the ability. So that's fine. I think that's right. I don't mean 100% regulation of that kind. I mean that if you even have the spirit of not elevating anonymity, if you just have the spirit of, you know, generally speaking, we think identifiability produces more social good than anonymity, you need to have a good reason to love anonymity so much. Just like we do with newspapers, just shifting your way of thinking, it will force Juicy Campus to go to Somalia, then it's not, you know, it raises its cost a little bit, the barrier to entry is higher, there'll be fewer Juicy Campuses. All that's fine, just like giving out handbills at night. I don't think the Western or Eastern world rises or falls in our ability to suppress every use of the word slut. I just think we, right now, the cost of it is zero. And I'm just suggesting that the cost should be just raised to even a few dollars would discourage a lot of it. And it will be raised to a few dollars. Getting at it through search is really another way to do it. You know, I started on this project this summer, and someone brought to my attention someone at Princeton who had been a subject of Juicy Campus. And so, you know, a few months since then, every time I run into an undergraduate, I ask them if they know Juicy Campus. It's a real undergraduate thing. I ask them if they know Juicy Campus. They do, unlike this room. They always do. They always know the name of people who've been targeted on their things. They don't really know much about other campuses. And then I say, does the name, her name's not Amy X. But then I say, does the name Amy X mean anything to you? And they go, oh, the girl at Princeton? Wow. Meaning, all over the country, people seem to know that there were these titillating, horrible things where you could go, boy, that's... No. No. It's just because... good question, why? There's some schadenfreude kind of thing there or something? I mean, there's something weird about being able to find out scurrilous things. There were some, I think pretty offensive things written about, mildly offensive things written about some faculty colleagues of ours on a couple of websites, blog kind of sites. I don't even remember where, before the spring, I think. They got an enormous number of hits. Everywhere I went, everybody had read them, ranging from senior partners at law firms to undergraduates. People like reading about, other people's hot babes or small breasts or, those are words like whoop. You go visit Sidley in Austin, everybody's going, well, can you believe it? Wow. There's something so vile about it to me, and I don't even feel that, repressed compared to most people, or at least most people my age. There's just something, sort of weird that this is what law's for. This is why we've created an internet and protected it with Section 230, and this is the game. I've never heard anybody say, there was a real insight about the Obama-McCain election on the internet that nobody else would publish. Thank God for the internet. No, we never hear that. Of course, we hear that many more people read about news because of the internet's availability, but that would happen under any legal regime, just about. Right, that could be the most restrictive of the five or six regimes I mentioned. It's really like my saying, how much useful information did you get in your life out of the bathroom stall? I think, do you mind that we erase the bathroom stall or make it vandalism to write on it? I can't imagine anybody saying, and you could say the same thing, you won't be able to wipe out the bathroom stall. People are in there, they're always going to demand privacy to do their human thing in there, and once that door's locked, they're going to scratch horrible things into the wall. Yeah, that's right. But it's pretty low harm, and it's pretty discouraged, and most of us would be embarrassed to be caught doing it. That's all I have in mind. I'm not looking for something crazy. I'm just wondering why we give it special treatment when it probably deserves average treatment in that group, especially because of the low barrier to entry. I'll just say one more thing about the low barrier to entry. I don't mean to be I'm surprised no one's yet asked this, so I'll ask this. But wait a minute, you should say. There's something wrong here. When it comes time to talk about television, people say, a little regulation's okay, because after all, it's a scarce resource, and there's a high barrier to entry, essentially. And then Levermore's talking about the internet, and he goes, there's probably an argument for a little bit of regulation, because after all, there's a low barrier to entry, and anybody can become an internet provider. If there's something a little bit wrong with a claim that you need regulation if something's cheap, and you need regulation if something's expensive, there's nothing left. It's like a libertarian nightmare. So you need to really examine those arguments carefully, and again, I think we understand the arguments. I don't know that television stations need the regulation they have. I'm not a big fan of them. I'm a little bit more worried about interest groups getting at the government. I think that's an explanation why the government feels empowered to have congressional committees as they're giving out airwaves and all that. And the low barrier to entry, it's really the other way around. It's that I think a bargain of all the internet providers, it's like the walls, would prefer there be a little bit of cost in order that their wall would be a little bit more valuable. I mean, that's really, they need a little law to help them. In a sense, and that's again my point.
I guess I'm wondering why you assume that in an ideal democratic society, Amy X, who would comprise the majority of people, would identify as a potential victim of gossip rather than as a gossiper and vote accordingly to ban them.
I think I'm just not being clear. I think that most of us can picture being the target, and we can also picture being the taunter. Or the gossiper. But when we experience or think about both experiences, we put a couple cents value on the ability to taunt people when we want, but we would put a couple $1,000 value on not being subjected the way Amy X was subjected. And therefore, overall, even if you felt really safe that no one would ever target you, if even 10% of people were afraid of being targeted sometime, they would overwhelmingly prefer to save the thousands of dollars than to make the pennies. So I think just the cost, it's like kicking. Why is there a rule against kicking? Why is that an intentional tort even, or certainly a tort? I think it's because although it might be fun sometimes when someone's getting on your nerves, they walk over and kick them in the shins. Vosburgh v. Putney them. I think we think, you know, the cost of being kicked is really pretty great. And offered a choice of a world in which you could free kick and in which you couldn't, I'm confident that 99% of people would vote for a world where it was costly to kick, even though they might sometimes prefer to be a kicker. And that's exactly how calling Amy X a slut seems to me. It's exactly like kicking. Of course, I appreciate that I sometimes, in my youth, wanted to kick people. And, you know, I'm happy to have lived in a society where there wasn't some crazy interpretation of an amendment that said it's important for democracy that people be able to go around and kick people because otherwise we'll get King George. And that's really my claim about Amy X. Yeah?
I'm wondering if the danger of anonymity being a little bit overestimated. In 10 years, if people vote you by his name, they're going to have a negative comment on them. And it seems that he's only become really popular if you become a politician or a movie star or something like that. But in general, if everyone has more negativity or can find more negative about people, you kind of end up being the same, and the harm isn't really as much as.
Yeah, I think it's a great question. I'm going to repeat it just because it might have been a little hard to hear. The question was, you know, maybe this isn't a I'll rephrase it a little bit. Maybe this isn't really as big a problem as you think, and it certainly won't be a big problem in 10 years, because as there's more and more information about all of us, there's going to be a lot of positive and a lot of negative about all of us, and you'll Google anybody, and there'll be a picture of them drinking too much, and a picture of them this, and a picture of them that, and besides, comments, true or false, about them, often false, that are about seeing them in strange places, or they cheated me. That's another interesting one in some of these sites. Never on Juicy Campus. They don't seem to care about cheating. But there are other sites where cheat, like on business sites, is a big thing. That store was a cheat, you know. And so if everybody's got comments about them that they're a cheat or a slut, yeah, we're in this odd situation now, you might say, where employers Google you, and if they see one negative thing about you, then apparently they think, why bother with this person in our summer program? I find that astonishing if true. But let's assume it's true, since our students seem to think it's true. But the comment is, that's only short-lived. In 10 years, there'll be true and false pictures of everybody in a drunken mess, mostly Photoshopped. And the employers and everybody will learn, you know, not okay. I take that very seriously. I have a couple reactions to it. The second one is the one you should pay the most attention to. The first one is just me. If you're right, we could accelerate it as a thought experiment this will sound nuts, but maybe we should go out of our way to post negative information about everybody. Let's all put pictures of ourselves in the most unflattering naked poses we can. I mean, it'll end a lot of problems and a lot of blackmail and a lot, you know, I mean, it just seems ridiculous that, you know, a picture of somebody with their clothes rotting a little bit high on their rear is all over the newspaper and costs them jobs. Okay, so let's just put out there a billion pictures of everybody's naked behind and get it over with. And, you know, it won't be embarrassing. Everybody, I mean, I really do think this sometimes, that a lot of these are just these crazy taboos, and we might solve the problem with much, 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 much more information. You know, sometimes the best way to make a friend is to confess your biggest sins or your biggest crimes in the past. It just relaxes everybody, you know. Trust me, when you think about going into a serious long-term relationship, don't hide the negative things about yourself. It's like threatening your whole life. Much better is make up some. I mean, just tell the truth, and then also tell them you stole a car in high school. And it just relaxes the whole thing. So I'm really with your question, though I realize that you won't jump out and do it my way. But my real reaction, now is that you should pay attention to my second one. My second reaction, my real one is, fine, but then that's true of these other media as well. It's not internet specific. That is, then that should be true of the newspaper and television and all that. Let's just not have different rules then. So it may be that this will solve itself with more information, but then I don't really see any reason why Amy X should have more to fear on the internet than anywhere else, and let's lighten up and get rid of defamation on the newspaper, or try to understand why newspapers are not allowing anonymous, scurrilous letters to the editor and all that. There's nothing special about the internet about that argument. Okay? I haven't been on that side of the room for a while. Yep.
I have a quick question about the harm Amy X suffered. So
about the harm.
The harm Amy X suffered?
Yeah.
So a lot of what you said was, you know, we shouldn't have anonymity because Amy X suffers. She's getting kicked on. She's getting kicked on and getting kicked. So I guess my question is, what's...
That's one of many possible solutions, I've said.
Okay.
One of several, but the easiest one.
Okay, so my question is, why do you think that people aren't
self-identifying that this information is false. So for instance, when we see in this recent election, there was lots of stuff about Karen that was put on the internet. Just like you said, fake pictures, rumors, something like true, and people say, oh, that's not true, what's on some website. When people go to the wall, don't they regulate themselves and say, oh, this is on the wall, it's not here, just like the bathroom stall, I'm not giving it as much credence if I read it in the Wall Street Journal, the New York Times.
Right. So that's really a corollary to this question, right? So again, I have sort of the same two reactions. One is, even if you're right, it devalues the wall. That is, screening for the good information on the wall is really costly and reduces the value to the wall entrepreneur. If you really do value speech and communication and political speech especially and all that, I can't imagine why you'd want to live in a world where it's full of crap and then we all have to screen to find a few tidbits of truth. Seems like, meaning we understand why our ancestors created some regulation to try to push things towards truth and away from defamation and the like, though we're always nervous that as they screen, they'll also screen out good stuff. I mean, I think we understand that, and we're not surprised to find some balance very much on the side of speak, 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 but with a little bit of control. Again, the only mystery is why in the world would the balance be different on the internet than everywhere else? Why should the internet be the outlier? Everything you say is true about all these media. And yet the other ones are subject to regulation against defamers and even against juvenileists. That's really my claim, that the internet does not deserve a privileged position. Indeed, the low cost of access suggests that we should be especially worried about the free wall problem, because we like the fact that everybody can set up a blog and set up a speech center and all that, and they need our help to make it worthwhile and not to be overrun by juveniles. That's exactly my point. It makes it no difference from the other media. So I was under strict instructions to stop by this time because we need to get to class by 1:30. Well, thank you very, very much. Come again.
This audio file is a production of the University of Chicago Law School. Visit us on the web at www.law.uchicago.edu.